Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. Ladies and gentlemen, today's Warner Archive Collection podcast is indeed very, very special. Not only do we have 11, count them, 11 new additions to the Warner Archive Collection, but we have a very special guest via telephone to discuss one of the Blu-ray releases that's new to the Warner Archive Collection that we're terribly excited about. It is V, the original miniseries. You've asked for it for years to finally be on Blu-ray, and we have answered the call, and we have with us today Mr. Kenneth Johnson, the writer, producer, director, and creator of V, the original miniseries that transfixed audiences on NBC 36 years ago and remains a vital part of our zeitgeist and our culture. Kenny, welcome to the Warner Archive Podcast. We're so delighted to have you on the phone with us.
Well, I am delighted to be here, guys. It was so exciting when I heard from you, George, that Warner Archive was going to create the Blu-ray because, as you said, and it's really quite true, so many hundreds of people, particularly in the last year or so, have emailed me and or questioned me in person asking, hey, how come there's never been a Blu-ray release? And I said, well, I don't know. And then suddenly out of the blue sky, George drops in and says, hey, guess what? And I was thrilled, and I'm sure the fans are going to be just as equally thrilled, particularly when they see the quality of it. It's super.
We're delighted to answer the call. That's what we're here to do, is give consumers what they want. And we knew they wanted this, and we had the great pleasure, Dan and Matt, being with you down in Comic-Con in San Diego, along with the star of V, Mark Singer, for a great panel last month at Comic-Con, for which we thank you.
It was really fun. It's always great to be able to be really in front of the people who care so much about our work and what we were trying to do and have been trying to do. And it's one thing to get emails from them, but when you can be face-to-face with a whole bunch of people that are just so eager to be there because they love your stuff, it's hard to be in a room where people love you and love your stuff and not be thrilled.
No. And you have a lot of stuff through your career that has made you beloved by fans of various different characters and series and things that you've been involved with. But I would assume that V is probably at the top of the list of things that people are most excited about.
Yeah, and you'd guess correctly. It's interesting. I mean, certainly there are a huge legions of fans for the Bionic shows and for the Bionic Woman that I created, and as well as for the Incredible Hulk, and also for Alien Nation. And all of those shows I'm really incredibly proud of. All of them were Emmy winners as well, and very successful in their own rights. It sort of became iconic in their own rights. But for me, V is the most standout piece for me personally, because in one way or another, the other shows were adaptations of something that was already existing. The Bionic Woman, of course, came from the $6 Million Man oeuvre, and the Incredible Hulk had started, of course, as Stan's comic book. And Alien Nation, of course, had been a not a very well-received movie, but a movie beforehand that I then began to bend around. But in the case of V, it was something that came entirely out of my little pea brain. And and because of that, I think I have a particular fondness and pride in the fact that something that really originated totally and entirely with me, I was lucky enough to be able to put together such a group of people to help me execute what I had in my head, and certainly the actors brought their contributions to it, as well as all of the technicians that worked on it with me back in the day when we were doing it. It's hard to believe it was 36 years ago, because it seems like an eye blink. But it was also one of the most fun times we had, and one of the most excruciatingly difficult because of the time frame that we were working under. And I think I mentioned to you once when we were having lunch how normally for a picture that's got a 65 people in the cast with speaking roles, plus all the visual effects, plus all the sets and things we had to build and coordinating all the locations, we should have had about 4 months or so to prep this project. And when I tell people that from the day that Brandon Tartikoff read the screenplay and said go until the day I said action was only 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
I was talking to somebody about it just yesterday who's a real industry pro, and they said, no, you can't do that. And I said, yeah, that's right, you can't. But but we did. And the miracle of it is that not only did we do it, but that it came together in such a way that it just captured the audience's imagination. And because of all of the contributions of all of the talented people that I had surrounded myself with. And it's easy to look good when you surround yourself with people who are smarter than you are and then listen to them. And that's what I tried to do. And so V is absolutely, I feel, is what I would say is my legacy piece and the thing that I'm really the proudest of all the work that I've done.
Would you kindly share with us the amount of viewers that initially tuned in to watch V over its two nights on NBC back in 1983?
Yeah, it was quite an amazing experience because we had done a really clever advertising campaign to catch the public's imagination. Because imagine this, too. Of all the miniseries that have ever been done, both then and since, V is the only one that did not have any TV stars in it, much less movie stars. It was a cast of really solid, wonderful actors, but nobody that was going to be drawing an audience of extra people because of their name value. And because of that, and I asked Brandon Tartikoff about that at the time, and he said no. He said, you know what, Kenny, the story that you're telling and the concept that you've created is so strong. And I was going, okay, Brandon, if you think so. But we did craft a wonderful advertising campaign where posters and billboards went up around the country 3 weeks before the show started. It was something that an idea that I had suggested to the head of advertising and publicity at NBC. I said, just put up propaganda posters like the Nazi propaganda posters that just say the alien visitors are friends, friendship is universal, all this stuff, but don't say anything about the show. Then 2 weeks out, just send around crews of kids with cans of red spray paint and deface your own poster with a big red V like the Resistance did in World War II. And then the last week, we just added a little banner that said the battle begins on NBC on May the 1st. And in addition to that, we created a countdown. So it was like only 21 days until they arrive. And by the time we got to the show was ready to, and just before the show went on the air, they previewed the piece to a number of the key reviewers around the country. And the critical response was just a waterfall of praise that I have never seen since, I don't think. It was just extraordinary. So we had all of that working for us to bring people in, and then, of course, it became the question of whether or not we would deliver what we had promised everybody for, and we sure did. The audiences came and they stayed. Not only were the ratings amazing, but they hung on and just kept getting higher as the evening progressed, and it was the highest rated program NBC had had in 2.5 years. It had a staggering 40 share, which means that 40% of the television sets that were on in North America were looking at V, which translated to about 80 million people. And then it was released the following year overseas, 1984. Okay, we were up against the 1984 Olympics, right? Well, we beat the Olympics 2-1 around the world in ratings. And oddly enough, I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, but the two countries where the ratings were the highest of all were Japan and Germany.
It's quite ironic, but that's absolutely fascinating, and I'm so grateful for you for giving us the context. For our audience listeners who don't know, Brandon Tartikoff was the legendary head of NBC in the 80s and was responsible for the must-see TV and
right. So
many things, and died at a tragically young age. But this is also representative of the way the television business used to be when studios were producing content and the networks were airing them. So it was a partnership. And now you have studios and networks generally being one. And this is a case where Warner Brothers Television produced the work to sell to NBC domestically and to other broadcasters internationally. So your relationship was both with Warner Brothers Television as well as NBC. So it was a convocation of support.
It was really interesting, too, the way that it it happened that way, too, because when I first talked to Brandon about the story, he just went crazy for it. He was looking for a very big, splashy event kind of piece, because at the time of the three networks, there were only three at the time, NBC was at the bottom of the heap. They were absolutely in the toilet with ratings, and Brandon was desperate to get something on the air that would really call everyone, pull everyone's attention to NBC so that they could, you know, lift up the thing. And it's funny, he told me on the show aired originally over two nights, Sunday night, May 1st, and Monday night, May 2nd. On Tuesday night, the overall ratings on NBC were about twice as high as they had ever been before. And part of the reason was, I think he felt that some people were coming back on Tuesday night to see if there was any more of V.
Right.
You know, but either way, it had the effect that Brandon was looking for, which was to open everybody's eyes to the fact that NBC could do something that was really spectacular and high quality, and it was a great experience.
Now, the miniseries at the time was very common. It was really at its peak during the 80s, and yet V stands towering above most others because of how popular it was and what you created. But one of the things that's really critical that we wanted to discuss on this podcast, in the 36 years since it aired, it has subsequently lived on, first on VHS and then on DVD in 2001, which you were personally involved in. And I want to talk a little bit about the choices that you made in regard to the aspect ratio, because when we started working on this and I had yet to connect with you personally, I had assumed, because there were many things done on DVD here at Warner Brothers in the early aughts, where a television production from years earlier was done in 16:9 widescreen because of a European television sale and not because of a director's intent. And I had no idea what the history was. I went into the files and found the documentation, because at the time this first came out, I wasn't involved in television content at Warner Home Video. I was involved in theatrical content only. So I was not aware of the communication that had gone on between you and the studio, and found out that this was at your direction and request, as a director has a right to do, as how his or her program is determined to be seen. And that's why it was a widescreen DVD. With the Blu-ray release, we have had a little bit of online controversy from people who think, oh, I want to see it the way it was shown when I was 8. And I respect people for having their opinion, but this was not a casual, oh, let's just make it widescreen studio decision. This was a director specifically intending to present what your vision was, because you had, I believe, intended that there would be a likely international theatrical and you wanted to be prepared for it. Could you talk about that? Because we want the words coming from you, not us.
Sure. Everything you said is right. There you go. Yeah, it's very simple. Everybody was filming for television in those days in what is called 4:3, that aspect ratio. It's for every inch across the bottom, for every 3 inches across the up and down, there's a 4-inch horizontal. So 4:3 was the normal television ratio. That's the way television screens were built. That's the way movies had been shot forever previously. So old movies that were shot like that until they got to CinemaScope and things like that, they were all shot in that same old 4:3 ratio. And when I had done the pilot for The Incredible Hulk back in the late 70s, I shot it that way in 4:3. And I discovered that Universal was going to release it as a foreign theatrical movie overseas. Actually, I didn't even hear about it until late after they'd already done it. And I said, well, God, what does it look like over there? Are they projecting it like that, or are they masking it so that it has seems to be in a wider screen? And the problem when they do that with a piece that's designed for 4:3 is that they cut off the top and the bottom pieces of the picture. And so what we did when I went to do V, I really felt that it would be likely that Warners would do a foreign theatrical release because of the nature of it, because of the genre, because of the popularity my stuff had already achieved overseas in foreign theatrical. And so I said, and also because I had a sense that it wasn't going to be too long before wider screen TVs were going to be the norm. So I said to my cinematographer, let's shoot it in the widescreen 1.85:1 aspect ratio, which is sort of the standard letterbox format and a theatrical format. But when you're doing that, you have to protect still for the 4x3 transmission on television. So if you looked through the ground glass on our Panavision camera, you would have seen two sets of lines. One was the letterbox 1.85, but in the middle of that was also the 4x3 aspect ratio so that the operator could make sure we were protecting the television image and not losing anything as far as the television screen was concerned. Of course, the screen that ends up on the DVD and on the Blu-ray is wider than a 4x3, and so nobody saw that at the time, but I knew that they would be eventually and very likely would be seeing it overseas that way. So nothing is lost at all, and only everything is gained by what we're seeing in the Blu-ray release, which is in 1.85, and it's more cinematic, and it certainly fits on today's TV screens, better. And sure, there are always some purists that want to see Casablanca with the old soundtrack and everything. But it was absolutely by design, and most everybody who has made any comments to me about it, I think I've only gotten one or two questions out of the thousands and thousands of emails people have written me asking, would it ever be released in the original TV format? And the problem is you really have to have an old TV to see it because you'd be looking at it on a 16:9 screen nowadays, and it's going to be black on both sides and just a little square box in the middle. And it's not nearly as beautiful as what the Blu-ray displays on the Blu-ray release now.
We would do that if that's what you had intended, but that was not what you intended. You intended a 16:9, 1.85 aspect ratio.
Right.
That was your vision. That's why you insisted upon it for 2001's DVD, and that's why we circled back to you when we started work on this Blu-ray to make sure that we were correct. I thought we were based on the files I found, and it was an opportunity for us to talk and have you involved at the beginning.
And that's great, and I appreciate that so much, and I must say that Warner Home Video did the same with me when we were doing the I remember the call that they got and said, we wanted to see what it would look like in 1.85 and letterbox, and it looks so good. Did you shoot it that way? And I said, yeah. I was excited that they were finally going to do a DVD release. I'd been after Warner Home Video to do it for a long time. And it was also amusing when I asked them what they were going to use for a soundtrack. And they said, well, we'll use the original. And I had to explain, you mean the original that was in mono? Because at the time, Warner TV wouldn't spend the money to let me mix it in stereo. Because at that moment, nobody was broadcasting television in stereo. Although I knew that they would be in about 20 minutes later,
Yeah, right. It was 2 years later before MTS came along.
Exactly.
Happily, we have that great Dolby Stereo track with the visual. And the response that when we were coming out with this was, I think, the biggest response we've ever had to any single announcement. And Dan and Matt can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the fans are just excited beyond belief. And by the time this podcast, which we're recording just before the release, by the time this podcast goes live,
right,
wherever our podcasts are heard, people will be able to go to their computers and order V and have a beautiful Blu-ray that has all of the painstaking talent and genius that you put into this work, which is why it thrives and lives and has such a following so many years later.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, from the beginning, V was what the studios and the networks call a four-quadrant hit, in that it attracted men, women, and teens and kids. It was everybody wanted to see it. V was never about spacecraft and reptilian races and stuff. It was really about power, a study of how people respond to power, how they either suck up to it to try to protect themselves or enrich themselves, or how they'll try to just keep their heads down and hope that if I don't bother them, they won't bother me. But then the people who are the heroes of the piece, obviously, are the ones who say, no, this power is being abused and we have to fight back against it. And they become the heroes of the resistance. And it's that sort of timeless story of like the American Revolution or Spartacus and the Revolt of the Slaves. It's a timeless story that is as apropos today, particularly in the current climate that's that's going on in the United States right now that people really stop and think about, okay, are we going to be drawn in as people on the alien planet had been by a charismatic who has not their best interest in mind?
The suspension of disbelief by introducing the fantastic sci-fi element actually made it more possible then and now, I think, for modern listeners to actually experience what it would be like to live under a rise of fascism.
That's exactly what I set out to do. I wanted to see how a spectrum of everyday people like us, like you and me and the people on the street, that's why there's no presidents and no generals or anybody like that. It's a neighborhood and it's people. And I wanted to see how various people would respond and how some people would be like the Vichy French and suck up to the Nazis and how others would just try to say, well, don't worry, it's okay, it won't bother me until I began to realize I can't make a long-distance phone call anymore, and then slowly the news tightens, and by having a Holocaust survivor, somebody who survived the fascist rise in Germany as one of the cast members, one of the players, who could see the historic relationships to it, or to apartheid, for that matter, in the years that have happened since then, was really vital, and I think that it caught people's imagination, and it's interesting, the letters I get so often say I was 10 or 12 when I first encountered V, and I was taken by the exact excitement and the razzle-dazzle and all of that, but now I'm 35 years old or something like that, and I'm looking at it again and realizing, oh, there was a whole lot more depth and allegory going on here than I realized, and I think that's what really has brought the success to it, because the performances that all of the actors gave was just so compelling and strong and believable that and as you said, the idea of it being an allegory because of the reptilian nature of the Nazis revealed a darker face to us. Well, so did our people physically relieve it. It was when we saw what was underneath their skin. And in both cases, it's a frightening and startling revelation and the kind of suspenseful thing that really, really draws people into what I always wanted to do. I was always hoped that everybody who was looking at it would try to figure out who they might be. Will I be one of the heroes, or would I be one of those that would fold up and collaborate? Oh, golly, or so it was really a work intended to have depth, and fortunately the audience and the critics particularly got onto what I was doing and really jumped for it. It was great.
And the important thing is to withstand the test of time. And we have other films in our library, films that predate World War II, that talk about what if, because they sense something bad was going to happen.
Yeah, right.
And we look at those works now as very prescient, and we analyze them from that perspective. Here we have something that is truly equally timeless, because its message in good times or bad times, its message is terribly important and terribly powerful, and it makes for something that lasts from generation to generation as something that will capture the audience's mind, imagination,
exactly,
and heart.
Yeah, it's funny because I reflect on the fact that my original script, the very first script I ever wrote, did not have any aliens or spacecraft in it, but it was about a grassroots kind of change in America that was suddenly, we were living in a different country overnight practically, and that's one of the feelings that that I wanted to capture about. And the title of that script, the original script, was called Storm Warnings, and because that's exactly how I saw it. I saw it as a warning to say, don't be too complacent, don't be things can change in a hurry, and also reflect that V came out long before 9/11 happened, and there had not been a major sea change in our life and our society since Pearl Harbor. And that's sort of what I wanted to say. Okay, how would you all react if you looked out the window and suddenly this 12-mile-wide spacecraft overhead, and suddenly you are in a different world? And it looks at first to be a charming, wonderful world because they're here to help. We're going to teach you how to build big spaceships like this. And then we slowly realize, oops, no, they got a darker agenda. And that's part of the suspense and fun, I think, of of the story of V and the danger that comes with it.
I think that's why we're so excited to be able to bring this film out, particularly at this time. And I say film, not television program, because it is not something that you look at as a work of television. It originally appeared on television. It was created for television, but especially framed within a theatrical aspect ratio and presented on a beautiful Blu-ray disc.
Well, that's it. And, you know, there's two things about that too, George. One is I approached all the work that I did, and I've had most of my career, the majority of my career, has been in television, but I've never thought of television as television versus being cinematic. And everything that I've done, particularly as a director, I have tried to make it as big and cinematic as I could, and that has always been my goal. And the other thing, and I think I mentioned this at the Comic-Con, the brilliance of the new Blu-ray edition that Warner Archive has created here is that it's the whole reason that I got into film as opposed to being in the theater, because I had started in the theater, but I realized that you can have a wonderful performance in the theater on stage, and we've all had moments like that. They're life-changing, where you see a performance that's just magnificent on the stage, but once the curtain comes down, the performance is gone, you know. And whereas if you can capture it on film, then you've got it, and you've got it forever. And particularly with the advent of the Blu-ray, where the quality is like four times better than the DVD, at least, and the sound quality is just as crisp and brilliant as it can possibly be. And this is really an archive piece that you have done in the best sense of the word, and it fulfills my expectations and hopes, because now I know that the people that came to see us at Comic-Con, I think maybe I said this to them, their children and their children's children will be able to see this Blu-ray edition, and it'll still be the same quality as it was when we originally envisioned it and created it. And that, to me, is the great blessing that Warner Archive has given me as a creative entity. And I'm so grateful to you guys for all the hard work that you put in to make the Blu-ray just as magical as it really is.
We are grateful to you, and on a personal level, I want to thank you for joining the gang at Comic-Con, speaking to the fans directly, because I know that was tremendously well attended, and people are still talking about it. And Dan and Matt, you were there, I wasn't. If you have anything to add,
I just want to say that I'm personally grateful to Kenny for the hours and hours and hours and hours of entertainment he's provided me over my life.
Oh, I was just going to say that there were some lizard men in the audience.
There were.
I know what person I was. I was on my best behavior.
And speaking of which character would you be, is it weird that I identified most with Robert Englund's character?
No, not at all. That doesn't surprise me, knowing you as I do. And as I think I've told you, that Bobby has shared with me a number of times that in spite of the enormous iconic nature he has developed with the whole Freddy role that he exploded into, he has always told me that the very first things that people always ask him about is V. And I just did an interview for a documentary that they're doing on him about how he has become an icon like Christopher Lee and so many of the other greats. And they have a poster that shows that. But right in the middle of it is Willie. and his little visitor hat. And that's the one that that people, you know, really, really glom onto. And that's been rewarding, too. I'm so lucky to have him as part of the original. And if we can get V the movie off the ground, which we're striving to do, as you know, I have some interesting thoughts about how to bring Robert back. And, the nice thing is about Aliens, for a trilogy, he doesn't get any older, you know, so I can use him again, and that would be great.
Well, we wish you all the best on the new project and have to offer our deepest thanks for your support of this release and for creating it. And on a personal level, having nothing to do with V, as we've discussed, many of my dear friends from my college days are actors and have worked for you and sung your praises, and actors love working for you. I can say that from personal experience of knowing them. And audiences love your work, which has stood the test of time, not mentioning just V, but but all your other works that people still are so enamored with. You've given so much, and especially to us in the Warner Archive today and our audiences here on the podcast by joining us for this interview. Thanks so much, Kenny Johnson.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, guys, for all your work, and I appreciate it. And any help I can be in the future as far as the Archive Edition is concerned, I'm standing by.
Thanks,
Kenny. We'll be in touch.
Okay, talk to you soon, fellas.
Well, indeed, we want to thank Ken Johnson, and V, I think, towers among all of his popular works, and it is not just the only Blu-ray we're bringing this week. We have two feature films coming to Blu-ray for the very first time that span 50 years of filmmaking. And we're going to talk about the newer one first. The late Nicholas Roeg directed an adaptation of Roald Dahl's novel The Witches, which was the last production of Lorimar's film entertainment division and became a Warner Brothers release by the time it was completed. And The Witches only appeared on DVD in a 4x3 pan and scan form. Mm. So a Blu-ray release was long overdue and in the proper aspect ratio. And I just want to go back to V for 1 second and clarify one point. There have been some online rumors or assumptions that there is a 4x3 HD television version. There isn't. There never was. There may have been some stations that aired the program and upconverted at the station level to a faux high definition, but there is no 4x3 high definition master and never was. Just to clarify that for those who have insinuated in online forums that such a thing exists, it was an up-res fake done at the station level. Back to The Witches. The Witches has been one of our most requested features, just like V was one of our most requested miniseries, and this features a bravura fantastic performance by the great Angelica Houston, and is in the process of being remade as we speak. So there's going to be a new version of The Witches heading to theaters in the future, which will probably be very different from this film. But the great thing about this movie is that a whole generation of kids grew up with this movie on video cassette, in theaters to some degree, because it was not a theatrical huge success, particularly on cable television. And it has a huge following, and people have been just so desperate for it. Those who have seen it thus far have absolutely been enraptured by the quality of the remaster that our wizards at Warner Brothers Motion Picture Imaging have created, and Mr. Roeg, having a background in cinematography, created a work that is quite gorgeous. And I think this is one of the releases I've been most delighted by in terms of how dramatically improved the quality is by having a Blu-ray presentation.
It looks so good. It's almost a different film, and yet it has all the charm and power that people remember. It's also what's really unique about The Witches is it is one of the last films to sort of find its legs well after release, because that phenomena just doesn't happen anymore.
And this is why you would want to take a more modern kind of stab at it, because this film has such a rich and almost advanced tapestry for a children's film with all of these incredible elements. And we also, this was Jim Henson's last film.
Yep.
And the puppetry work on it is also amazing. And so you take a visionary filmmaker, a visionary child author, and these visionary effects and mix it together, and with wonderful performances and makeup effects
from everyone.
It's just so richly layered that I think that in 1990, they didn't really know what to do with
it. They absolutely didn't. It actually sat on the shelf for a year, from my understanding. It was completed under the Lorimar regime, and I think that Warner Brothers took over the last remnants of it, and there were some changes made, and there just wasn't a clear champion of the film within the company to guide it to a release. And the marketing of a release then as now, when it comes out to theaters, can make or break. You can have a wonderful movie, and if the marketing campaign doesn't work and you don't get the people into the theaters, you're in trouble. And what can happen, not as much these days, but as Dan mentioned, especially in those days, was something could not make its goal theatrically and really explode through television and home video. And some examples of that are films like Willy Wonka, mm-hmm. which was a huge failure at the box office, and Warner Brothers acquired it years after it was produced, and through home video availability and television broadcasting, it became one of the essential films of all time. And The Witch is, to a lesser degree, but still substantially, has a great following, and it was crying out for a Blu-ray release, and we're so proud of how gorgeous it looks and how great it sounds, and it's just something I think all the creative people who were involved with it would be very proud of.
People who came of age at this time, like The Witch stands in their pantheon films the way Willy Wonka or Wizard of Oz does for older viewers.
For respective of the 70s or the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Because it's more episodic, which kids like, and it goes from one almost surreal setting to the next.
And speaking of episodic, briefly, if you're not familiar with The Witch, a young boy discovers the existence of a coven of witches who have a secret, horrible plan for children, but they turn them into a mouse. So it's about a mouse trying to defeat witches. And Angelica Houston is the High Witch.
She had won the Oscar for Supporting Actress for Pritzi's Honor. This was really a great period for her as an actress. And she's still underappreciated, in my opinion.
Yep, yep.
You know, I can't sing her praises high enough. And this film honors all her talents. And those talents, of course, are inherited from a long line of talented Houstons that came before her. Her father, John Houston, her grandfather, Walter Houston. And the last of our new Blu-rays is certainly not least, because this is an Oscar winner and a combination of star and director that would repeat itself to great acclaim again. But in 1938, Betty Davis was united with director William Wyler, who was on loan from Goldwyn Pictures, to direct Jezebel in 1938 from Warner Brothers, and Miss Davis earned the second of her Best Actress awards as the Best Actress of 1938, playing a Southern belle, Julie Marsden, opposite the great Henry Fonda, in an adaptation of a play that was not a success on Broadway, but given the fervent power of Gone with the Wind being the hit novel of the era and being produced across the city by David O. Selznick, Jack Warner decided to create a Southern Belle story for Betty Davis that gave Betty Davis a consolation prize of great significance for not getting the role of Scarlett O'Hara. And when Jezebel came out, as a matter of fact, David O. Selznick famously wrote a letter to Jack Warner, kind of being a little unnerved by some of the similarities in the characters. But they're completely different films. They're completely wonderful films. And you've got the combination of Wyler behind the camera. You've got Betty Davis giving one of her greatest performances. Fonda, on loan from Fox, is a wonderful leading man opposite her. Faye Bainter won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for a really phenomenal performance as well. And once again, underscoring all of the activity, as he did do with Gone with the Wind, is the amazing Max Steiner. And this is a story of love and loss and bravery and
vengeance
as well as
a monochromatic red dress.
One of the most famous scenes in the movie is when Betty Davis's character goes to a ball with Henry Fonda wearing a red dress, and never so clearly in a black and white film has the scope of a red dress made so much of an impression. But the other thing that's so amazing about this Blu-ray is our DVD looked pretty ratty, and the film elements of this title had been ravaged by the success of the movie. The movie was re-released in the 40s, shorn by quite a substantial amount of footage in a shorter version, and we were able to find a nitrate lavender fine grain as a source for this remaster, which started as a 4K scan as part of Warner Brothers' preservation program, since the original camera negative no longer exists. And from that 4K scan came this beautiful new master, which literally underwent the removal of thousands of artifacts and specks of dirt and an enormous amount of cleanup and the resulting picture. I never thought we could get this movie to look gorgeous, and it does.
It's insanely different. That's the only way. I mean, we normally, I've said many times, oh, this looks really good. But
this looks brand new.
Yeah, it looks.
It's brand new.
It's stunningly brand new. And Don't know how else to explain it.
You can see the moisture glistening in her eyes.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm not giving any secrets away here because we've already announced through social media that a forthcoming Wyler Davis collaboration is on the way. That being The Letter.
Bang, bang, she
from
shot
1940,
me down.
which it's tremendously exciting because we can't get enough Betty on Blue. And for those of you who are asking about Errol Flynn and Bogart and Cagney, we're going to get to them as quick as we can, as long as we can do it right and make the films look gorgeous. And we're very proud of this, and it comes with a boatload of extras, a lot of which are on the DVD. There is a great featurette about the making of it, a wonderful commentary from Janine Basinger from Wesleyan University, and we have Daffy Duck in Hollywood in HD as a classic Warner cartoon. And we even found a little two-minute piece of a rambling reporter. It was a teaser for Jezebel, talking to Betty Davis out of costume and out of character about Jezebel.
That mind going for a walk? Sure, Betty.
It was something that I had never seen before, we've never released before. And the reissue trailer is there in HD as well, so it's a fantastic package. And we've got a lot to be proud of as we're bringing you the people what you want on Blu-ray. And we're also bringing some films back in print on DVD, and a bunch of them star the glorious, glamorous Natalie Wood. We have Cash McCall from 1960, co-starring James Garner. We have Sex and the Single Girl, in which she co-stars with Tony Curtis, with whom she would reunite a year later in one of our favorite films, The Great Race. And also you've got Henry Fonda again playing opposite Lauren Bacall in this adaptation of Helen Gurley Brown's novel of 1964.
And you can't see it on the radio, but there's big quotes around adaptation.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's kind of like when they made a movie of everything.
We wanted to know about sex. Yeah.
I mean, they took a nonfiction book and made a still in the code sex comedy of the 60s.
But this is certainly a code cracker, I would call this.
Yeah, a little bit, absolutely. We also have from 1963 the last of many cinematic collaborations between the queen of comedy from television, Lucille Ball, and her oft-paired co-star Bob Hope, with whom she made several feature films at Paramount and one at United Artists, and their last film together was Critics' Choice from 1963, which was a Warner Brothers adaptation of a hit Broadway comedy. So that's back in print. And also back in print, we have The Cincinnati Kid, Norman Jewison's wonderful film starring Steve McQueen, Edward G. Robinson, Anne Margaret, and can't forget Joan Blondell, because this is a Warner Archive podcast.
Tuesday Weld,
who is wonderful any day of the week. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Or as they called her on the Flintstones, Wednesday, Thursday. Love that. We also have Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, the great horror Hammer classic, back available on DVD, as well as Oliver Stone's The Hand from 1981. Peter Weller stars in Of Unknown Origin.
A personal favorite.
From 1983. That's back in print on DVD. And a film we had the pleasure of bringing to Blu-ray about 5 years ago, now is available again on DVD, back in print, and that is Michael Wadley's Wolfen, starring Albert Finney. And that wraps up the 11 new releases for this week's Warner Archive podcast. We also want to remind you about the Warner Archive Room on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and click on the classic genre in the iTunes movie store, you will find a Warner Archive banner down at the bottom of the page. And if you click on that, that will take you into the Warner Archive Room on iTunes, where you'll find feature films from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond, many of which you can can buy or rent in HD that aren't available on Blu-ray yet. And there are television series there, and there are animated series there, and animated cartoons there, and our almost 400 podcasts, which date back to 2009, are there for free. So it's a wonderful place to explore. You can go to iTunes.com/Warner Archive if you're getting there from the internet. We also highly recommend that you send us letters through the mail, and we'll read them here on the podcast, but I don't believe we have any this week.
We had 4 last week, so we're out. But please, please send us new letters. Any question you want, we read it live on the air, and send them to Warner Archive Podcast, 3400 Riverside Drive, B160-4, Burbank, California, 91522.
So that wraps up this Warner Archive Collection podcast, but fear not, we will be back real soon with a host of new exciting Blu-rays and DVDs to talk about, which are sure to tickle your fancy. But until that time, I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
Girls don't have to simper around in white just because they're not married.
Thanks for listening, and look forward to the next Warner Archive Collection podcast.